Chapter 34. It had happened again. Jesus. Two more ungodly murders. An FBI helicopter was waiting for me at the airport in Fresno. I was flown to Las Vegas, where an FBI sedan was waiting. The driver, an agent named Carl Leonards, informed me that Director in Charge Craig was already at the crime scene. Then Leonards filled me in on the rest. The latest murders had taken place at a five-diamond luxury hotel, the Bellagio. When it opened in 1998, the Bellagio was the most expensive hotel ever built. It was upscale and family-friendly, until now anyway. There was hardly a trace of the old Las Vegas, no naked ladies, no mobsters in shiny sharkskin suits. Las Vegas police cars and EMS vehicles were parked all over the approach driveway from Boulevard South, which is Route 604. There were at least a half a dozen TV vans on the property. I estimated that 500 to 600 onlookers were gathered outside the hotel. Why was the crowd so large? Exactly what had happened inside? All I had so far were sketchy details of the murders. I knew that the bodies had been drained, but not hung. As I made my way through the onlookers, I saw something that bothered me, shook me up even more than the news of the murders. There were at least a dozen men and women dressed in goth attire. Black frock coats, top hats, leather pants, long boots. One of them smiled right at me. He showed off a set of sharpened, very nasty-looking fangs. He had on blood-red contacts that glowed. He seemed to know who I was. "Dude," he smirked, "welcome to hell." There was nothing I could do about the ghouls. I kept on walking toward the Bellagio. These strange role players seemed to have no qualms about being at the crime scene. Were the killers here? Were they watching? What did they expect to see next? What did the murders mean? I hoped that the Vegas police or the FBI was filming the crowd gathering outside the hotel. I figured that Kyle would have taken care of that. I was here for one reason. I can put together details at a murder scene that other cops usually can't. It was why Kyle Craig had asked for me. He understood my strengths and probably also my weaknesses. The suite where the couple had been murdered was large and relatively tasteful by resort standards. The first thing anyone entering the bathroom would notice was a marble bathtub and a tinted glass window overlooking a man-made lake and several fountains. Two bodies were in the tub. I could see the tops of their heads and a couple of bare feet. As I got closer, I saw that the man and the woman had been bitten and also cut several times. The nude corpses were eerily white. There hadn't been anywhere to hang them inside the suite. There wasn't much blood in the tub itself, but it had been stoppered. The room was buzzing with police activity, too much to suit me. There were LVPD detectives, paramedics, crime scene scientists, a pathologist, the coroner's investigative team, and the FBI, of course. I needed quiet. I studied the pale, pathetic bodies for several minutes. As was the case with all the victims so far, the man and woman had been attractive. Perfect specimens. Chosen for that reason? If not, then why? The girl looked to be in her early 20s. She was petite, blonde, slender, probably under 100 pounds. The span of her shoulders was only about a ruler's length. Her breasts were small and had been bitten, almost shredded. There were bite gouges up and down her legs. The male appeared to be in his early 20s as well. He was blonde and blue-eyed, with a corn-fed look. His body was toned and sculptured. He too had been bitten. His throat had been slashed, and so had his wrists. I could see no defensive bruises on their hands. They hadn't fought back, had they? They knew the attackers. "You saw the ghouls lurking outside?" Kyle asked. "The semi-human freak show?" I nodded. "It's daylight, though. The ones out there must be harmless. The ghouls in their crypts are the ones we need to find." Kyle nodded. Then he walked away. After most of the police technicians left, I wandered around the hotel suite for several hours. It's a ritual for me, part of my own obsession. Maybe I feel I owe it to the dead. I stopped and I stared out at the view of the lake that the victims had enjoyed. I noticed everything. The creamy whites, blushing pinks, and 60s parish yellows that colored the room. framed mirrors spotlighted by recessed lights, fresh fruit and flowers. The victims had unpacked and put away their clothes. I went through them. Bob Mackey dresses, high-heeled shoes by Jimmy Choo and Manolo Blahnik, a couple of skirts. Expensive, chic, the best of everything. The last thing either of them had expected was to die. A stack of $50 and $100 markers from the Venetian in New York, New York, were in plain view on the dresser. The killers had left the chips. Also, two full vials of cocaine in the woman's purse, a carton of Marlboro Lights. Was it to tell us they weren't interested in money and drugs, in gambling, in cigarettes? What were they interested in? Murder? Blood? Ticket stubs were inside the woman's purse. Souvenirs? Passes to MGM Grand Adventures. Tickets for shows at the Circus Circus, the Folie Bergeret and the Tropicana, the magicians Siegfried and Roy, a half bottle of Lolita Lampica perfume. The man had kept a few restaurant receipts, Le Cirque and the Bellagio, Napa, the Palm, Spago at Caesars. There are no tickets or receipts for last night, I said to Kyle. We need to find out where they went. Could be where they met the killers. They must have gotten friendly with them. They let the killers in here. Chapter 35. The cell phone in my pocket went off. Shit! Damn it! Why do I carry these infernal gadgets? Why does anybody in their right mind need to constantly be on call? I glanced at my watch as I took the phone in hand. It was already 11 o'clock. What a life. So far, we knew that Andrew Cotton and Dara Gray had gone to the Rum Jungle for drinks and then a magic show at the Mirage. They were seen talking to two people, but it had been dark in the theater. That was what we had so far, but it was still early. I had been at the Bellagio murder scene since early evening. The case was really getting under my skin. The murders were brutal, primal. I had read about similar murders in Paris and Berlin, biting attacks, but I had never seen anything like this with my own eyes. Alex Cross, I said into the phone. I turned towards the picture window, revealing the lake and the desert in the distance. The view was soothing, an incredible contrast with what had happened in the suite. It's Jamila, Alex. Did I wake you? No, not hardly. I wish you had. I'm at a murder scene. I'm in Las Vegas, staring out at the desert. Well, you're up pretty late yourself, I said. It was good to hear her voice. She sounded sane and normal. She was sane and normal. I was the one in trouble.
Oh, I sometimes stay at the office late. That way I can get a day's work done after everybody else goes home. Alex, I have some information to share on the biting attacks.
From the sound of her voice, I suspected this wasn't going to make things any easier for me. Go ahead, Jamila. I'm listening.
Okay, she said. I've been working with a couple of medical examiners from the other places where the bloodsucker struck. I think we may have hit on something important in San Luis Obispo, and then again in San Diego.
I was listening. Jam had my full attention.
In both of the cities, the medical examiners really got into the case, really tried to help. As you know, we exhumed in San Luis Obispo. Then Guy Milner, the ME in San Diego, did the same. I won't bore you with all the details right now, though I can overnight them to your hotel.
Well, that would be great. Obviously no faxes on any of this material.
Here's what we found out. In both these murders, the teeth marks are different than in San Francisco or L.A. The marks were made by human teeth, Alex, but the killers were not the same ones. The evidence is pretty conclusive. Alex, there are at least four killers out there working. At least four. We've identified four different sets of human teeth so far.
I was trying to make some sense of what I just heard. These are bodies that were exhumed? Human teeth could leave bite marks on bone?
Yes. The MEs agreed on that. The enamel on teeth is the hardest substance in the human body. Also, as you know, the killers might have been wearing enhancers.
Fangs?
Right. There was gnawing on the bones in San Diego. That's another reason why there were clear marks.
Gnawing? I winced.
Well, you're the psychologist, not me. Gnawing entails strong, repetitive, intentional action. It could definitely account for teeth marks. One of the victims was an adolescent. The other was in his 50s. That helped us some, too. According to my sources, the adolescent's bones had less density. So did the older person's due to osteoporosis. Thus, the clear marks. But why gnaw on the bones? You tell me.
I was thinking about it. How about this? Inside the bone is the marrow, and the marrow is rich in blood vessels.
Oh, Alex, yuck, Jamila said. That could be it. How perfectly awful.
Chapter 36. The murders of the two actors exploded the media awareness of the case. Suddenly, we had hundreds of tips to check and way too many bogus leads to follow. According to the tips, Dara Gray and Andrew Cotton had been spotted in nearly every club and hotel in Vegas. It was just what we didn't need to deal with. We had decided not to release the information that there might be more than one set of killers. California and Nevada weren't ready for it. Kyle Craig decided to stay out west for the next couple of days. So did I, of course. I didn't have much of a choice. The case was too hot and seemed to be revving up even more. Over 1,000 local police and FBI agents were involved on some level. Then, the killing simply stopped. The pattern that had seemed to be escalating and building ended. The killers, who had seemed to be getting bolder, just vanished. Or maybe we weren't finding the bodies anymore. I was talking daily to profilers in Quantico, but none of them could discern a pattern that made sense to any of us. Jamila Hughes couldn't come up with interesting leads or theories either. Everyone was completely stumped. The killers just stopped killing. Why? What was going on? Had the publicity scared them off? Or was it something else? Where had the killers disappeared to? How many were there? It was time for me to go home. That was the good news, and I took it for what it was. Kyle agreed, and I headed back to Washington with the uncomfortable feeling that I had failed, and that maybe the murderers would get away with what they had done. I got to the house on 5th Street at 4 on a Monday afternoon. The home front looked a little worn, but also comfortable. I made a mental note that I had to paint the outside. The gutters needed work. Actually, I looked forward to it. Nobody was home. Nobody was there. I'd been away for 14 days. I had wanted to surprise the kids, but I guess that was another bad idea. They seemed to be coming in clusters lately. I wandered around the house, taking it all in, noting little things that were different since I had left. The kids' All the Rage razor scooter had a broken back wheel. Damon's white coral robe, sheathed in a plastic dry cleaning bag, hung over the banister. I was feeling guilty as it was, and the quiet, empty house didn't help. I looked at a few framed photos on the walls. My wedding photo with Maria, school portraits of Damon and Janie, snapshots of little Alex, a formal picture of the boys' choir taken by me at the National Cathedral. Daddy's home, Daddy's home. I sang an old 60s tune as I peeked into the upstairs bedrooms. Shep in the limelights, I muttered. Nobody was around to care that I was singing old rock and roll tunes and trying to lighten the mood. The Capitol and the Library of Congress were within walking distance, and I knew Nana liked to take the kids there sometimes. Maybe that's where they were? I sighed and wondered once again whether it was time for me to get the hell out of police work. There was one catch. I was still passionate about the work. Even though I'd failed on the West Coast, I usually got some kind of results. I had saved some lives in the past few years. The FBI brought me in on some of their toughest cases. I figured this was my bruised ego talking, so I stopped the internal bullshit, cut it right off. I took a hot shower, then I changed into a Men's March t-shirt and jeans, flip-flops. I felt a lot more comfortable, like I was back in my own skin. I could almost make myself believe that the lurid vampire killers were gone from my life for good. I think that's what I wanted to happen. Just let them crawl back into their hole. I went down to the kitchen and grabbed a Coke from the fridge. Nana had taped a couple of the kids' masterpieces to the door. Intergalactic Encounter, by Damon. And Marina Scurry Saves the Day, again, by Janelle. A book was laid out on the kitchen table. 10 Bad Choices That Ruin Black Women's Lives.
Nana was doing a little light reading again. I peeked inside to see if I was one of the 10 bad choices. I wandered out to the sun porch. Rosie the cat was asleep on Nana's rocker. She yawned when she saw me, but didn't get up to rub against my legs. I had been away too long. "Traitor," I said to Rosie. I went over and scratched her neck, and she was okay with it. I heard footsteps on the front porch. I walked to the foyer and opened the front door. Light of my life. Janny and Damon looked at me and screeched, "Who are you? What are you doing in our house?" "Very funny," I said. "Come and give your daddy a big hug. Hurry, hurry!" They ran into my arms, and it felt so good. I was home, and there was no place like it. And then I had a thought I didn't want to have. Did the mastermind know that I was here? Was our house safe anymore? Chapter 37. At its best, life can be so simple and good, as it should be. On Saturday morning, Nana and I packed up the kids and we headed over to their favorite place in all of Washington, the huge and wonderful and occasionally elevating Smithsonian Complex. We were all in agreement that the Smithsonian, or Smitty as Janny has called it since she was a very little girl, was where we wanted to be today. The only issue was where to go once we got there. Since Nana would be there for only a few hours with little Alex, we let her pick the day's first stop. "Let me guess," Janny said and rolled her eyes. "The Museum of African Art?" Nana Mama shook a finger at Janny. "No, Miss Weisenheimer. Actually, I'd like to go to the Arts and Industries Building. That's my choice for today, young lady. Surprised? Shocked that Nana isn't the creature of habit you thought she was?"
Damon piped up. "Nana wants to see the history of black photographers. I heard about it at our school. They got cool black cowboy pictures. Isn't that right, Nana?"
"And much, much more," said Nana. "You'll see, Damon. You'll be proud and amazed and maybe stimulated to take a few more photographs than you do. You too, Janny. And Alex as well. Nobody takes pictures in this family except me."
So we went to the Arts and Industries Building first, and it was very good, as it always is. Inside, the dull roar of air conditioning and the cries of a gospel album mixed nicely. We saw the black cowboys, and also a lot of exceptional photos from the Harlem Renaissance. We stood in front of a 12-foot photo of ambitious-looking black men in suits, ties, and top hats, taken from a bird's-eye view, a stunning shot that would be hard to forget.
"If I saw that scene on the street," Janny said, "I would definitely take the picture."
After Arts and Industries, we appeased Janny and went to the Einstein Planetarium, where we watched And a Star to Steer Her By for the fourth or fifth time, or maybe the sixth or seventh time, but who's counting? Nana took little Alex home for his nap then, and we trekked around the rest of the Air and Space Museum. This was the portion of our journey that Janny called Damon's Macho Planes and Trains Trip. But even Janny enjoyed Air and Space. The Wright brothers' plane floated high above us, suspended by long wires, and it was magnificent. Light spruce beams and stretched white sheets of canvas. To its right, the Breitling Orbiter 3, another important page from aeronautic history, the first non-stop balloon flight around the world. And then, one small step for man, the 13,000-pound Apollo 11 command module. You can be cynical about all this, or go with it. I chose to go with it. Makes life a lot easier and more rewarding. After we had studied several of the aeronautic miracles, Damon insisted we catch Mission to Mir on the IMAX screen at the Langley Theater.
"I'm going to outer space one day," he announced. "I have news," Janny said. "You're already there."
In honor of Nana, we stopped at the Museum of African Art, and the kids got a kick out of the masks and ceremonial clothes, but especially the old currency exhibit, cowrie shells, bracelets, and rings. It was incredibly quiet inside. Spacious, colorful, cool as could be. The last stop of the day was to see the dinosaur hall at the Museum of Natural History. But then both Janny and Damon said we had to see the tarantula feeding at the Orkin Insect Zoo. There was a sign we read on walls painted to resemble a rainforest. Insects won't inherit the earth.
They own it now.
You're in luck, Janny teased her brother. Your kind rules.
Finally, at around 6, we crossed Madison Drive to the mall. The kids were quiet, tired, and hungry by then. And so was I. We ate a picnic supper under spreading shade trees at the foot of the Capitol. It was the best day I'd had in weeks. No calls from anybody.
Chapter 38. As he had done so many times before, probably a dozen times by now, the mastermind watched Alex Cross and his family. Love equals hate, he thought. What an incredible equation, but so true, absolutely true. It made the world go round, and that was a lesson Alex Cross needed to learn. Christ, he was such a fucking optimist. It was infuriating. If anyone had cared enough to study his past carefully, they would have discovered the keys to everything that had happened so far. His personal crime and murder spree was one of the most daring in history. It had lasted for over 28 years. He could count the mistakes he'd made on one hand. The keys were right there for anybody to see. Narcissistic personality disorder? That's where it all began. That's where it would end. A grandiose sense of self-importance? That was him, all right. Expects to be recognized as superior without commensurate achievements? Preoccupied with fantasies of unlimited success, power, brilliance, or ideal love? Interpersonally exploitive? Yes, indeed. He lived for it. Lacks empathy, to put it mildly. But please note, Dr. Cross, and others who might wish to study the long and winding trail, this is a personality disorder. There is no psychosis involved. I am an organized, even obsessive thinker. I can work out elaborate plots that serve my need to compete, criticize, and control, the three C's. I am rarely impulsive. Questions you should be asking about me. Are my parents alive? Answer, yes and no. Was I ever married? Answer, yes. Any siblings? Answer, oh, absolutely. Nota bene. If I'm married, do I have any children? Answer, 2 genuine American beauties. I saw that movie, by the way, loved Kevin Spacey, adored him. And am I attractive or physically flawed in some minor way? Answer, yes and yes. Now, do the homework. Draw the love and the hate triangles in my life, doctor. You're in the triangles, of course. So is your family. Nana, Damon, Janny, and Alex Jr. Everything you care about and think that you stand for is right there in those beautiful triangles, wrapped up in my obsessions. So unravel it, before it's too late for both of us, not to mention everybody you care about in the world. I'm right outside your house on 5th Street, and it would be so easy to barge inside right now. It would have been easy to kill you and the family at the Smithsonian, the Smitty, as your daughter calls it. But that would be too easy, too small. And, as I've been trying to tell you, the phone in the mastermind's hand was ringing, calling, reaching out to touch somebody. He patiently let it continue. Finally, Cross picked up. I have a grandiose sense of self-importance, the mastermind said.
Chapter 39. I settled back into my duties in Washington, where I took some abuse from my detective pals about how much I seemed to be enjoying working with the Federal Bureau lately. They didn't know that I had been approached about becoming an FBI agent, and I was actually thinking it over. But I was still drawn to the mean streets of D.C. I had a decent week on the job, and when another Friday rolled around, I also had a date. It struck me a long time ago that the best thing that ever happened to me was being married to Maria and having 2 great kids with her. It's not an easy thing to play the dating game at any age, especially when you have kids, but I was committed to it. I definitely wanted to be in love again, if I could. to settle down, to change my life. I suppose that most people do. Occasionally, I would hear my aunt say, "Poor Alex, he doesn't have anyone to love, does he? He's all alone, poor baby." That wasn't exactly true. Poor Alex, my butt. I have Damon, Janny, and little Alex. I also have Nana, and I have lots of good friends in Washington. I make friends easily, like Jamila Hughes. So far, I haven't had trouble getting a date either. So far. Macy Francis and I had known each other since we were little kids growing up in the neighborhood. Macy went on to get a couple of degrees in English and education at Howard and Georgetown. I went to Georgetown, then Johns Hopkins for my doctorate in psychology. About a year ago, Macy returned to the Washington area to teach English Lit at Georgetown. We met again at one of Samson's parties. We talked for an hour or so that night, and I found that I still liked her. We agreed to get together again soon. I called Macy when I got home from my bust of a trip to California. We met at the 1789 restaurant for drinks and maybe dinner. Macy's choice. It was near her place in Georgetown. The restaurant is in a federal-style townhouse at 36 and Prospect. I got there first, but Macy arrived a few minutes later. She came up, gave me a sweet kiss on the cheek before we sat down in the cozy pub. I liked the fleeting touch of her lips, the smell of a citrus fragrance on her neck. She had on a lilac turtleneck sweater, sleeveless, a black skirt that lightly hugged her, suede slingback heels. She had small diamond studs in her ears. As far back as I could remember, Macy had always dressed well. She'd always looked nice, and I guess I had always noticed. "You know, I'll tell you a secret, Alex," Macy said, once we had ordered glasses of wine. "I saw you at John Sampson's party, and I thought to myself, Alex Cross looks better than he ever did." I'm sorry, but that's what went buzzing through my head. We both laughed. Her teeth were even and shiny white. Her brown eyes were bright and intelligent. She had always been the smartest in her classes. "I thought the same thing about you," I told her. "You like teaching okay? The new job at Georgetown working out? The Jesuits leaving you alone?" She nodded. "My father once told me you're lucky if you ever find something you like to do. Then it's a miracle if you can find somebody who'll pay you to do it. I found both, I guess. How about you?" "Well," I said seriously, "I'm not sure if I love my job or if I'm just addicted to it. No, actually, I do like it most of the time." "You a workaholic?" Macy asked. "Tell the truth now." "Oh, no. Well, maybe. Some weeks I am. But not this week. At least not tonight." "No, this week has been mostly relaxed. Tonight is very relaxed. I need a whole lot more of this," I said, and laughed. "You look relaxed, Alex. It's so nice seeing you again." Macy and I continued to talk easily. A few people were eating at banquettes in the pub room, but it was mostly quiet. Parents of Georgetown students often take their kids to 1789 for a special meal. It is special. I was glad I was meeting Macy here. She'd made a good choice. "I asked some girlfriends about you," she confessed, then giggled. "Alex Cross is not available," a few of them said. "He's kind of a coconut," one sister said. The other girl said she was crazy as a loon, but are you? I shook my head. People are funny, how they need to make judgments on everybody else. I still live in the old neighborhood, don't I? No coconuts live in Southeast. I don't think so. Macy agreed with that. "Now you're right, you're right. Not too many people understand how we grew up here, Alex. I was named after a damn department store. You believe that?" "I do. I grew up here, Macy." We clinked our glasses and laughed. "I guess I'm lucky my name isn't Bloomingdale." A couple of times I brought up dinner, but she was more comfortable sitting and talking. "I know Chef Ree Lacoste, and I love her cooking. I had my heart set on crab cakes garnished with her special slaw. But we drank another couple of glasses of wine, and then Macy started to get a little ahead of me with the wine orders. "You sure you don't want to eat something?" I asked a little later.
"I think I already told you that I didn't," she said. Then she forced a smile. "I like what we're doing here. Just talking, chilling. Don't you?"
I did like talking to Macy, but I hadn't eaten since breakfast, and I needed to get some solid food in me pretty soon. I was hungering for some thick, luscious black bean soup. I glanced at my watch and saw it was already 10:30. I wondered what time 1789 stopped serving. Macy began telling me about her marriages. Her first husband had been a bum and a loser, and the second, a younger man from Grenada, was even worse, she said. She was getting a little loud, and people at the bar were starting to notice us.
So here I am, 37 years old. I had to go back to work even though I didn't want to. I'm teaching freshmen, Alex. English composition, world lit. God knows seniors are bad enough.
I was sure she had said she liked teaching, but maybe I heard her wrong, or she was being sarcastic. I wasn't doing much talking anymore, just listening to her stories. And eventually, Macy noticed. She put her hand over mine. She had the smoothest brown skin.
I'm sorry, I got carried away, Alex. I talk too much, don't I?
So I've been told. I'm really sorry. We haven't seen each other in a long time. Lots to talk about. She looked at me, and she had such beautiful brown eyes. I was sorry that she'd been hurt in her marriages. Hurt by love. It happens to the best of people sometimes. Macy was obviously still hurting.
You do look great, she said. And you listen pretty good for a man. That's important.
You too, Macy. I like your stories. Her hand was back on top of mine, her nails lightly grazing my skin. It felt nice, actually. There was nothing too subtle going on here. She let her tongue wet her upper lip. Then she lightly bit down on the lower. I was finally starting to forget that I was hungry for the crab cakes and black bean soup at 1789. Macy was quietly staring into my eyes. We were both adults, unattached, and I was definitely attracted to a lot of things about her.
My place isn't far, Alex, she said. I don't usually do this. Come home with me. Just walk me home.
Her place was only 10 blocks away, so I walked Macy there. She had a little trouble walking, and her speech was slurred. I put my arm around her, held her steady. Macy's apartment was on the ground floor of a townhouse near the university. It was minimally furnished. The walls were painted pale green. Against one wall was a black lacquered upright piano. A framed magazine article about Rudy Crewe caught my eye. The educator's words were set in large type. Education is about the distribution of knowledge, and to whom we actually distribute this particular commodity is a major question in this country. Macy and I held each other and cuddled for a moment on the living room couch. I liked her touch, the way she kissed. This wasn't right, though. I knew that I didn't want to be here, not tonight anyway. Macy wasn't at her best right now.
Good man's hard to find, Macy said, drawing me close.
She was still slurring her words a bit.
You have no idea. No idea. So hard out here. It's hell.
I did have some idea about how hard it was to find someone to be with, but I didn't pursue the point. Maybe some other time. Macy, I'm going to head home, I finally said. I like seeing you again. I liked it a lot.
I expected as much. I knew it. She exploded on me. Just go, Alex. Go! I don't want to fucking see you again.
Before the anger had welled in her eyes, I had seen something beautiful and nearly irresistible. Now it was gone again. Maybe she could get back in touch with it. Maybe not. Then Macy started to cry, and I knew enough not to try and comfort her. I didn't want to be condescending. I just left the apartment, with its beautiful piano and the wonderful quote from Rudy Crewe. This woman wasn't right for me to be with. Not now, anyway. Sad night. A good woman is hard to find, too, I wanted to tell Macy. God, I hated dating.
Chapter 40. The night with Macy Francis kept bothering me for the next few days. It was like a sad song that played in my head. I hadn't expected it to turn out that way. I didn't like what I'd seen or felt. The look in Macy's eyes stayed with me. A terrible mixture of hurt, vulnerability, and anger that would be hard to soothe. I grabbed Samson on Wednesday night after work.
We agreed to meet at the Morgue for drinks. The bar was a couple of streets down from Fifth, local hangout. Tin ceiling, wide board pine floors, long worn mahogany bar, ceiling fan turning lazily. "Sugar, damn," Samson said when he arrived and found me sitting by myself, nursing a foggy bottom lager while studying the old Pabst clock on the wall. "You don't mind me saying, you look like shit, man. You sleeping all right? You're still sleeping alone, aren't you?" "Good to see you too," I said to him. "Sit down and have a beer." Then Samson wrapped one of his mammoth arms around me. He hugged me as if I were his little kid. "What the hell is going on with you?" he asked. I shook my head. "Don't know exactly. The manhunt on the West Coast went real bad. I mean, it dried the hell up. There's no word on Betsy Cavalier's murder, either. Had a date the other night. Just about had me swearing off dating for the rest of my life." Samson nodded. I knew the words to that sad song. He ordered a bud from the bartender, an ex-cop we both knew, Tommy DeFeo. "The case I was working on in California ended really badly, John. The killers just disappeared. Thin air. So, how are you doing? You look good. For you." He raised an index finger, then he pointed it right between my eyes. "I always look good. It's a given. And don't try to change the subject on me. We're into something here." "Oh, hell, you know I don't like to talk about my troubles, John. So tell me about yours." I started to laugh. He didn't. Samson just looked at me, said nothing, waited me out. "You'd probably make a decent shrink," I told him. "Speaking of which, have you been to see the good doctor finally lately?" "Adele finally is my psychiatrist. Samson has also seen her a couple of times. She helps. Both of us agree on that. We're fans of Adele." "Nah, she's really pissed off at me. Says I'm not trying hard enough. Says I won't embrace my own pain. Words to that effect." Samson nodded and smiled thinly. "So why is that?" I made a face. I didn't say that I agree with Adele. I sipped my foggy bottom. It wasn't too bad, and I liked being loyal to a local brewer. When I try to embrace the goddamn pain, I keep coming back to the conflict between the job and the life I think I want to lead. I missed another one of Damon's concerts while I was out in California. Stuff like that keeps happening. Samson punched my shoulder. "Well, that's not the end of the world, you know. Damon knows you love his little ass. The young dude and I talk about it sometimes. He's over it. Now you get over it." "Maybe it's just that I've worked on too many bad murder cases in the past few years. It's changing me." Samson nodded approval. He liked that answer. "Sounds like you're feeling a little burned out." "No, I'm feeling like I'm caught in a scary nightmare that won't go away. Too many coincidences whirling around me. The mastermind howling my name, threatening me. I don't know how to make it all stop." Samson stared into my eyes. He locked into them. "Back there, little bitch, you said coincidences, sugar. You don't believe in coincidences. That's what makes it so scary. If you want to know the truth, I think that someone really is after me. And they've been after me for a long time. Whoever it is, he's scarier than the vampires. I keep getting calls from somebody, John. He calls me every day. Hardly misses a day. We can't trace the calls." Samson ran a hand across his forehead. "Now you're scaring me. Who would be stalking you? Who would dare to take on the Dragon Slayer? Must be some kind of fool." "Believe me," I said, "this is no fool." Chapter 41. Samson and I stayed at the Morgue later than we should have. We drank a lot of beer and finally closed the place down at around 2. We were smart and sane and sober enough to leave our cars in the parking lot instead of driving home. John and I walked home under a bright moonlit sky. It reminded me of the two of us growing up in Southeast. We had to walk just about everywhere we went. Maybe we'd take a city bus if we were feeling flush. He dropped me off at my house and continued toward the Navy Yard in his place. Early the next morning, I had to retrieve my car before I went to work. Nana was up with little Alex, and I drank a half pot of her coffee, then put the boy in his stroller. He and I walked to my car. The morning was clear and bright.
and the neighborhood seemed peaceful and quiet at around 7 o'clock.
Nice. I've lived on 5th Street for 30 years, ever since Nana moved there from her old place on New Jersey Avenue. I still love the neighborhood, and it is home for the Cross family. I don't know if I could ever leave.
Daddy was with Uncle John last night. I bent down and talked to the boy as I pushed his blue and white striped stroller along. A nice-looking woman passed us on her way to work. She smiled at me like I was the best man in the history of the world because I was walking my child this early in the morning. I didn't believe it for a second, but I enjoyed the fantasy. Little Alex is very alert at 9 months, and he likes to watch passing people, cars, the clouds streaming above his little head. He loves rides in the stroller, and I like pushing him, talking or singing kiddy ditties as we go about our business. "See the wind blowing the tree leaves," I said, and he looked up as if he understood every word. It's impossible to tell how much he understands, but he seems responsive to what I say. Damon and Janie were the same way, though Janie was constantly babbling as an infant. She still loves to talk, and to get in the last word, and the next to the last, just like a grandmother. And also, now that I remember, her mother, Maria. "I need your help, buddy," I stooped down and talked to little Alex again. He looked up at me, smiled beautifully.
"Sure, Daddy, you can count on me."
"It's your job to hold me together for a little while. You give me something precious to focus on. Can you do that?" Alex continued to smile.
"Of course I can, Daddy. It's no problem. Consider it done. I am your precious. Lean on me."
"Good boy. I knew I could count on you. Just keep doing what you're doing. You're the best thing that's happened to me in a while. I love you, little buddy." As I was talking to my son, though, a little of the feelings of the night before rolled over me like some cold, wet fog coming up from the Anacostia River. Coincidences, I remembered. The bad things that had happened around me for the past 2 years. A real bad run. The murder of Betsy Cavalier. The mastermind. The vampire killers. I needed for it to let up some. Needed to come up for air. When I got to headquarters that morning, a message was waiting for me. There had been another vampire murder. But the game had just changed, taken another turn. This one had taken place in Charleston, South Carolina. The killers were on the East Coast again. Part 3. Murder in the South. Chapter 42. I flew to Charleston and arrived a little before 10 in the morning. The local murder story was boldly splashed across the front pages of the Post and Courier, and also USA Today. I could feel uncertainty and fear in the bright, sterile, overly commercialized confines of the airport. Travelers I passed seemed nervous and wary. Several looked as if they hadn't slept well the night before. I'm sure that some of them felt that if the mysterious killers could strike in the heart of Charleston, they could do it in an airport waiting room or food court just as easily. No one was feeling safe anywhere. I rented a car at the Charleston airport, and then I set off for a spot called Colonial Lake in town. A male and female jogger had been murdered there at around 6 the previous morning. The couple had been married for just 4 months. The similarities to the murders in Golden Gate Park were unmistakable. I'd never been to Charleston, though I'd read books set in the city. I soon discovered for myself that Charleston is physically gorgeous. Once upon a time, it had been a city of incredible wealth, most of which came from cotton, rice, and slaves, of course. Rice had been the biggest export, but slaves, who were brought into Charleston port and sold throughout the South, were the import that proved the most profitable. Wealthy planters had traveled frequently between the plantations in the lowlands and their homes in Charleston, where the important balls, concerts, and masquerades were held. Relatives of Nana Mamas had been brought into Charleston port and sold there. I found a parking spot on Beaufin Street, which was lined with Victorian-style houses and was lovely. I even spied a few English gardens. This wasn't the kind of place where ghoulish murders ought to happen. It was too pretty, too idyllic. Was that what drew the killers here? Did they appreciate beauty? Or hate it? What were they revealing to us with each new murder? What was their dark fantasy, their horror story? If Charleston was suspicious and fearful about the murders, then the streets around Colonial Lake seemed close to terror. People eyed one another warily and coldly. There was nothing even close to a welcoming smile, no Southern hospitality on display anywhere. I had left a message for Kyle to meet me at the lake. It was surrounded by wide sidewalks and wrought iron benches. Yesterday, it had probably appeared picture-perfect and completely safe. Today, bright yellow crime scene tape was set up near the intersection of Beaufin and Rutledge. The Charleston police had surrounded the area and were watching everybody as if the killers might return. I finally saw Kyle waiting under a spreading shade tree, and I walked toward him. The morning was warm, but there was a breeze off the ocean that smelled of salt and fish. Kyle had on his usual attire, gray suit, white shirt, and nondescript blue tie. He looked like the playwright and actor Sam Shepard, even more so today than usual. Kyle looked gaunt, tired, almost as haunted as I felt. The murders were getting to him, too. Something was. It must have been like this yesterday morning, though it was earlier when they struck the couple, I said as I came up to Kyle. No one saw anything? No witnesses in an area like this? That's what I read in the police briefs. Kyle sighed. We actually have a witness who saw two men hurrying out of the park. Man in his mid-80s. He said he thought he saw blood on the shirts of the men, and he felt he was mistaken. Then he found the bodies. I quickly surveyed the scene at Colonial Lake again. The sun was shining brightly, and I was forced to shade my eyes. Birds were twittering in several of the trees. The park was so open to scrutiny. They were out in broad daylight. Some vampires, I muttered. Kyle eyed me. You're not starting to believe in vampires. I believe that there are people who practice a vampire lifestyle, I told him. I know some of them believe they're vampires. Even some of the role players sport very sharp teeth, fangs. They can be violent. I haven't seen any shape changes yet. Otherwise, our witness might have seen a couple of furry bats winging it out of here instead of two men. That's supposed to be funny, Kyle. What else did our witness say about the men he saw? Well, not a lot. He thought they were young, Alex, 20s or 30s, which covers a hell of a lot of territory. They were walking quickly, but didn't seem alarmed that he saw them. He's 86, Alex. He seems, shall we say, distracted by all the attention he's getting. Whoever the killers are, they're certainly bold, or stupid. I wonder if these are the same bastards we chased through California and Nevada. Kyle lit up a little. He had something to tell me. My people in Quantico were up half the night. Again. Alex, they've come up with a dozen East Coast cities with unsolved murders that could be connected to the others. What's the time frame of the murders, I asked. That's the really interesting part. This may have been going on for a long time. Nobody seems to have put these cases together before we came along. The time frame is at least 11 years. Chapter 43. That night, Kyle and I had dinner with a good friend in Charleston. Actually, Kyle made the arrangements, including reservations at the Grill on North Tyron. Kate McTiernan hadn't changed much since we had been thrown together during the Casanova murder spree in Durham and Chapel Hill, North Carolina. When the murderer Casanova had kidnapped Kate in her house outside Chapel Hill, he believed she was the most beautiful woman in the South. Not only that, Kate was extremely smart. She was a doctor now, a pediatrician, but she was thinking about becoming a surgeon. When Kate arrived at our table, Kyle and I were in deep conversation. Actually, we were arguing about possible next steps in the investigation. Hi, guys. Lustrous brown hair framed Kate's face. She was wearing her hair longer these days. Her eyes were dark blue with a nice sparkle. She was still in terrific shape, but I knew she was a softy deep inside. Give it up, Kate said. You boys are working way too hard. We're going to have some fun tonight. Seeing her there got us both up out of our chairs, grinning like idiots. We'd gone through a lot together, and survived to be together again for this unlikely dinner in Charleston. This is a great coincidence. I was at a medical conference just outside town, Kate said as she sat down with us. Alex doesn't believe there are coincidences, Kyle said. Well, fine. So here we are again, brought together by divine intervention or whatever, praise the Lord, Kate said and grinned.
Well, you seem in excellent spirits, Kate, Kyle said. He was actually pretty buoyant himself.
Well, Kyle, this is just such a nice, unexpected treat. Why wouldn't I? I get to see the two of you. Plus, I am in excellent spirits. I'm getting married next year in the spring. My Thomas proposed 2 nights ago.
Kyle fumbled out a congratulation, and I called over our waiter and ordered a bottle of champagne to celebrate. For the next few minutes, Kate told us all about her Thomas, who owned and ran a small, nicely snooty bookstore in North Carolina. He was also a landscape painter, and Kate said he was exceptional at both his jobs.
Of course, I'm hugely biased, but I'm also a picky little bitch, and he really is good. He's a fine person, too. Well, how are Nana and the kids? How's Louise, Kyle? She asked. Come on, tell me everything. I've missed you two.
By the end of dinner, we were all in good spirits. The champagne and the company did the trick. I had noticed before how Kate could raise up everyone around her, even Kyle, who usually isn't the most social person. All through dinner, he rarely took his eyes off of her. The three of us hugged outside the restaurant at around 11.
You two are coming to my wedding, Kate said and stamped her foot. Kyle will bring Louise, and Alex, you'll bring the new love of your life. Promise?
We promised Kate. She left us no choice. We then watched her walk away toward her car, an old blue Volvo that she made house calls in. I like her a lot, I couldn't help stating the obvious.
Yes, I like her too, said Kyle,
who didn't stop watching until Kate's car was gone from sight.
She's a very special girl.
Chapter 44. We were connecting some of the dots now. Finally. I hoped we would be able to put together the whole vampire puzzle soon. By the following afternoon, the FBI had identified 12 eastern cities where murders involving vampire-like bites had occurred as early as 1989. I put the names on one of my index cards. Then I stared at the list long and hard. What could possibly link these cities? Atlanta, Birmingham, Charleston, Charlotte, Charlottesville, Gainesville, Jacksonville, New Orleans, Orlando, Richmond, Savannah, Washington, D.C. The breadth of the list was a problem. Scarier and more mystifying was the fact that the murders might have been going on for over a decade. Next, I made an even longer list of cities where non-lethal attacks by supposed vampires had been reported and investigated. I stared at the list and got a little depressed. This was starting to look like an impossible conspiracy. New York City, Boston, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Virginia Beach, White Plains, Newburgh, Trenton, Atlanta, Newark, Atlantic City, Toms River, Baltimore, Princeton, Miami, Gainesville, Memphis, College Park, Charlottesville, Rochester, Buffalo, Albany. The violent crime unit in Quantico was working round the clock on the murders. Kyle and I were pretty sure that other cities would turn up, and that the pattern might go back longer than 11 years. In Atlanta, Gainesville, New Orleans, and Savannah, there appeared to have been murders in at least 2 different years. So far, Charlotte, North Carolina was the worst hit. There were 3 suspicious murders going back to 1989. It was even possible that the killing spree had started in Charlotte. The FBI had moved agents into the 12 cities where murders had happened, and special task forces had been set up in Charlotte, Atlanta, and New Orleans. I finished up with my investigation in Charleston. It didn't accomplish too much. At this point, the media didn't have the story about the wide net of murder cities, and we wanted to keep it that way for as long as we could. That night, I visited Spooky Tooth, the only club in the Charleston area that was a hangout for goths and vampire wannabes. What I found there was a nest of young people, mostly under 20. They were still in high school or college. I interviewed the owner of the nightclub and questioned some of the clientele. They were definitely angry and restless, but no one seemed a likely murder suspect. I made sure I was back in Washington the next afternoon. At 7:30, Nana, Janny, little Alex, and I went to a boys' choir concert. The choir sounded better than ever. Damon was one of the featured singers. He had a beautiful solo. The Ash Grove.
See what you've been missing?
Nana leaned in close and said.
Chapter 45. William and Michael liked being in the South. It was wild and free-spirited, just like they were. Most important, they were right on schedule. They had arrived in Savannah, Georgia. William drove the van along Oglethorpe Street and stopped at the famous Colonial Park Cemetery. Then he went on to Abercorn. Then along Perry Street, passing Chippewa and Orleans Squares. He told Michael, lectured to him, "Savannah is built on its dead. A whole lot of this port city is built on the graveyards." Also that Savannah had been spared in the Civil War and now was one of the best-preserved southern cities. William liked this beautiful city very much and was pleased that they had to take a victim in Savannah. It would be a pleasure to feed here and to fulfill their mission. He lost track of the street names as he took in the sights of the historic district. Magnificent federal period townhouses, 19th century churches, fancy ironwork with scrolls and Greek motifs, flowers everywhere. He admired the famous old houses, Green Meldrum, Hamilton Turner, Joe Odom's first house. "It's beautiful and elegant," he told his brother. "I could live here. You think we should settle down one day? Would you like that?" "I'm famished." "Let's settle down soon," Michael replied with a laugh. "Let's settle down and feast on the finest that Savannah has to offer." William finally parked the van on a street called West Bay, and he and his brother got out and stretched their arms and legs. Two young girls in Savannah College of Art and Design t-shirts and blue jean cutoffs came strolling up to the van. They had long, shapely legs, butterscotch tans, and seemed not to have a care in the world. "Can we give blood here?" the smaller of the girls asked with a conquering smile. She looked to be around 16 or 17. She had lip studs and wild cherry jello-dyed hair. "Aren't you the dainty morsel?" said Michael as he locked eyes with the girl. "I'm a lot of things," she said, and looked over at her friend. "But dainty sure isn't one of them. Don't you agree, Carla?" The other girl nodded and rolled her green eyes. William looked the girls over and thought they could do better in Savannah. These two tramps weren't worthy of him and Michael. "We're closed for business right now, sorry." He was polite and smiled graciously, even seductively. "Maybe a little later, ladies. Why don't you two come back tonight? How about that?" The short girl snapped. "You don't have to get an attitude. We were just making conversation." William lazily ran his hand back through his long blonde hair. He continued to smile. "Oh, I know that. So was I. Who could blame me for chatting up two beautiful girls like yourselves? Like I said, maybe we'll see you later tonight. Of course, we'll take your blood for the cause." William and Michael decided to take a stroll toward the Savannah River and an area called Riverfront Plaza. They barely noticed the freighters and tugs on the water, or the gaily festooned paddle boat, the Savannah River Queen, or even the waving girl statue, towering in bronze, a young woman waving a sad farewell to departing sailors. They preferred to check out the men and women walking through the plaza. They were looking for prey, even though they knew it would be dangerous to strike here in broad daylight. A flea market was in progress, and the various local artists had drawn a respectable crowd, a few soldiers, but mostly women, some of them very attractive. "I do want to take someone, maybe right here in this oh-so-fucking-pretty river park," William finally said. "He'd do nicely," Michael said as he pointed out a slender male in a black t-shirt and blue jean cutoffs. "Or maybe just a snack. How about that delectable 2-year-old in the sandbox there? Yum! Much better than that sickly sugar sweetness I smell everywhere." William enjoyed his brother's humor. "That's pralines you smell. The barbecue is supposed to be especially good here, too. Very spicy," he said. "I don't want any stringy pork or beef," Michael wrinkled his nose. "Well," William finally began to relent, "maybe we could have a quick bite. What do you see that you like? You can have anything you want." Michael pointed out his choice. "Perfect," whispered William.
Chapter 46.
This was bad. There had been another grisly vampire-style murder in Savannah. Kyle and I rushed down to Georgia in a shiny black Bell jet helicopter that would have done Darth Vader proud. Kyle wouldn't let the case go. He wouldn't let me go either. Even from the air, the seaport city was stunningly beautiful, with its clusters of mansions, quaint shopping districts, and the Savannah River winding through golden yellow marshes out to the Atlantic. Why were the attacks taking place in crowded, attractive locales? Why these particular cities? There had to be a reason this was eluding all of us so far. The killers had to be playing out a complex story fantasy. What the hell was it? An FBI sedan was waiting, and it rushed us to the Cathedral of St. John the Baptist. The church was on East Harris, in the historic district. Police cruisers were parked everywhere among the antebellum homes. So were EMS vans. The highways around Savannah are completely blockaded, Kyle told me, as we made our way through the heavy traffic near the church. This is the most bizarre and lurid thing to happen around here since John Barron's book. Or, I suppose, the murder that inspired it. Should bring in lots more tourists, though, don't you think? Maybe the vampire tour will come to rival the one for Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. Not the kind of visitors the Chamber of Commerce, or especially the residents, probably want to see here, I said. Kyle, what the hell is going on? The killers are working right in our face. They're telling us something. They strike in beautiful cities. They murder in public parks, in luxury hotels, even in a cathedral. Do they want to get caught? Or do they believe they can't be caught? Kyle looked at the church spires up ahead. Maybe it's a little of both. I agree, though. They are reckless for some reason I don't quite fathom. That's why you're here. You're the profiler. You're the one who understands how their sick minds work. I couldn't get the thought out of my head that these killers wanted to get caught. Why did they want to get caught? Chapter 47. Kyle and I got out of the sedan and hurried toward the Cathedral of St. John the Baptist. A gold and white banner over the main door proclaimed, "One Faith, One Family." The twin spires of the church rose high over the city of Savannah. The style was French Gothic. Grand arches and traceries, impressive stained glass windows, an Italian marble altar. I was taking everything in, everything, but nothing had clicked yet. The murder had been discovered less than 2 hours ago. Kyle and I were in the air minutes after we heard the news from the Savannah police. The story was already all over TV. The sweet smell of incense was in my nose. I could see the victim as we entered the cathedral. I groaned and felt a little sick to my stomach. It was a 21-year-old male, which I had known from the early reports, an art history major at the University of Georgia named Stephen Fenton. The killers had left Fenton's wallet and money. Nothing had been stolen, except his shirt. The cathedral was large and could probably hold as many as 1,000 worshippers. The flow of light from the stained glass windows created a pattern of colored patches on the floor. Even from a distance, I could see that the victim's neck had been torn open. The shirtless body was toned and sculpted, just like the others. It lay at the foot of a Station of the Cross, the 13th. The floor was stained with blood, but not much liquid remained. Did they drink the blood here in the cathedral? Was this about sacrilege, religion, the Stations of the Cross? Kyle and I approached Stephen Fenton. A body bag was already laid out in the nave. Technicians from the Savannah Police Department stood by. They were restless and angry, anxious to do their work and get out of there. We were holding them up. The local medical examiner was doing his examination of the body. Kyle and I knelt over the body together. I pulled on a pair of plastic gloves. Kyle almost never used them. He rarely seemed to touch evidence at a crime scene. I'd always wondered why. His instincts were good, though. But if we were both so good, why didn't we have any clue as to where the killers had gone or when they might strike next? That was the question that nagged me more and more at each murder site. What was this gruesome rampage about? They're so goddamn impulsive, I muttered to Kyle. I suspect they're both under 30, maybe early 20s or even younger. I wouldn't be surprised if they were in their late teens. Makes sense to me. They don't seem to have any fear at all. Kyle spoke softly as he looked at the student's wounds. It's as if a wild animal has been turned loose, like the tiger. First in California, now here on the East Coast. The problem is that we don't really know how far back the killings go, or how many killers are involved, or even if they're working out of this country. That's three problems, three subsets that require answers we don't have. Your agent's still talking to people at the goth and vampire clubs? The internet? Somebody has to know something. If anybody knows, they're keeping it to themselves. I have over 300 agents full-time on this case, Alex. We can't keep this heat up. I looked up at the wooden station of the cross. It depicted Jesus being taken down from the cross and laid in his mother's arms. The crown of thorns, the crucifixion, piercings, blood. Was blood the connection here? Eternal life? I wondered. In Santa Barbara, Peter Western had mentioned that some vampires were spiritual. Was this a ritual killing or a random one? Should I talk to Peter Western again? He seemed to know more about vampires than anyone else I'd met. The victim was wearing khaki trousers and new Reebok sneakers. I examined the wounds to his neck. There were also gouges on his left shoulder and parts of his upper chest. One or both of the killers was very angry, close to a rage state. Why take the shirt? Kyle asked. Same thing in Marin. Maybe because it was blood-soaked, I answered, as I continued to look at the student's wounds. These are definitely human bites, but they're attacking like animals. The tiger is a model, a symbol, something important. What, though? Kyle's cell phone sounded and he flipped it open. I couldn't help thinking of the mastermind, his constant calls to me. Kyle listened to whoever it was for about 20 seconds. Then he turned to me. We're going to Charlotte right now. There's been another murder, Alex. They struck again. They're already in North Carolina. God damn them. What the hell are they doing? Kyle and I raced toward the doors of the cathedral. We ran as if we were being chased. Chapter 48. Every once in a while, a single murder or series of murders horrifies us, catches the public's imagination in an almost obscene way. Jeffrey Dahmer's bizarre spree in Milwaukee, the murder of Gianni Versace, and subsequent killings by Andrew Philip Cunanan. The Russian, Andrei Chikatilo, reputed to be the worst. Now this bloody rampage on two coasts of the United States. It was fortunate that we had the FBI helicopter to get us out of Savannah and over to Charlotte. While we were still in the air, Kyle was in contact with his operators on the ground, who had surrounded a ramshackle farmhouse about 14 miles outside Charlotte. I had never seen Kyle so animated and excited about a case before, not even Casanova or the gentleman caller. Looks like we caught a break, Kyle said to me. No one will get out of that house until we get there. I like our chances. We'll see, I said. I'm not convinced these are the same people. I had stopped making assumptions about the killers. Why Charlotte, North Carolina? This would be the fourth attack in the same city. Had everything been leading us to Charlotte? Why? Kyle listened to another situation report from agents on the scene. Then he related the relevant details to me. The parents of a 17-year-old Charlotte boy were attacked in bed late last night, both bludgeoned to death. A claw hammer was found at the scene. There were bites on the bodies. There's evidence that either a large animal attacked the two adults, or the assailant was wearing sharpened metal fangs. Kyle rolled his eyes. He still didn't have much truck with vampires. The boy then fled to an abandoned farmhouse near the Loblolly River outside Charlotte. As far as we know, the people loitering in the house are mostly teenagers. Apparently, some are as young as 12 or 13. It's a mess, Alex. Everything is on hold until we get there. The age of some of these kids is a real problem. A little more than 10 minutes later, we landed in a wide meadow brimming with wildflowers. We were less than 3 miles from the house where the killer might be hiding. This was Bonnie and Clyde stuff. By the time we got to the thick woods surrounding the house, it was past 5 o'clock. It would be dark soon enough. The house was a two-story wood frame structure obscured by an overgrowth of wisteria and myrtle. Pine cones, hickory nuts, and what are known locally as sweet gum monkey balls covered the ground where we hid and watched. Everything about the place brought back memories of where I had grown up in the South. Not too many happy moments, unfortunately. My mother and father had both died in their 30s, well before their time. My therapist has a theory that I see myself dying young because both my parents did. The mastermind seems to hold a similar theory, and perhaps wants to put it into action soon. The roof of the old house was sharply pitched. A narrow attic window was broken in two places. The peeling white-painted clapboards were mostly intact, and the asbestos-shingled roof was bare in spots, revealing tar paper. Creepy, creepy, creepy. The FBI was super sensitive to the fact that most of those inside the house were probably under 20 years old. They didn't know exactly who they were or if they had any police records. There was no proof they were involved with the murders. It was decided that as long as we remained undetected, we'd wait until night to see if anyone left or entered. Then we would move on the house. The situation was getting sticky, maybe political, and there would be consequences if a minor got hurt or killed. In sharp contrast, everything seemed peaceful in the woods. The ramshackle house was strangely quiet, considering all the young people who were supposed to be in there. No loud laughter or rock music. No smells of cooking. Dim lights were flickering. My growing fear was that the killer was already gone, that we were too late. Chapter 49. Someone was whispering close to my ear. It was Kyle. "Let's go, Alex. It's time to move on them." At 4 a.m, he gave the signal to breach the house. Kyle was calling all the shots. He had authority over the locals, too. I accompanied a dozen agents outfitted in blue windbreakers. Nobody was feeling too secure about the raid. We moved cautiously to within 75 yards of the house, the edge of the pine forest. Two snipers, who had dug in about 30 yards from the house, radioed that it was still quiet inside. Too quiet? "These are mostly young kids," Kyle reminded us before we went in. "But protect yourselves first." We crawled on our hands and knees until we were as close as the snipers. Then we rushed the house, using three entrances to get inside. Kyle and I went through the front, the others through the side and back. A couple of flashbang grenades went off. There was screaming on the ground floor, high-pitched, kids. No gunshots yet. It was a weird, chaotic scene. Stone kids, lots of them, most in their underwear or nude. At least 20 teenagers had been sleeping on the ground floor. No electricity, just candles. The place smelled of urine, weed, mildew, cheap wine, and wax. Insane clown posse and killer priest posters were hung on the walls. The tiny front hall in the living room merged into an open area. The kids had been asleep on blankets or just the wooden floor. Now they were awake and angry, shouting, "Pigs! Cops! Get the fuck out!" Agents were rousting more of them on the second floor. There were fist fights, but still no gunshots. No one seriously hurt yet. A sense of anticlimax. A skinny boy screamed at the top of his voice and rushed at me. He seemed to have no fear. His eyes were blood red, color contacts. He was growling and drooling frothy saliva. I took him down in the headlock, cuffed him, told him to chill before he got himself hurt. I doubt that he weighed much more than 140 pounds, but he was wiry and stronger than he looked. An agent near me wasn't so lucky. A heavy-set red-headed girl bit him in the cheek as he was attempting to restrain her. Then the girl bit into his chest. The agent howled and struggled to get her off. She held on like a dog with a bone. I yanked the girl away and cuffed her arms behind her back. She wore a black t-shirt with "Merry fucking Xmas, bitch" printed on it. She had tattoos of snakes and skulls everywhere. She was screaming in my face, "You are unworthy! You suck!" "The one we want is in the cellar. The killer," Kyle called to me. "Erwin Snyder." I followed him through a dysfunctional kitchen, then out back to a slanted wooden door that led to a cellar. We had our guns drawn. Based on what we knew about the viciousness and suddenness of Erwin Snyder's attack, nobody wanted to go into the cellar. I yanked open the door and we edged inside. Kyle, two other agents, and I went down three rickety wooden steps. It was quiet and dark. An agent worked a flashlight around. Then we saw the killer. He saw us, too.